Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
And I was the king of razor blade editing back in the day. I mean, I was really good at it. And
the fastest blade in the West.
I would have a band play three or four takes and say, okay, go to the pub and get a beer and come back in 45 minutes and I'll put a master take together. And it was great.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
When you got to the studio for the first time, Butch, you know, did you think, now's my chance to be, you know, Keith Moon or the fantasy drummer that you always wanted to be? Did you ever do like the inappropriate drum part?
You know, I think in the first band I was in high school, Eclipse, we played covers. We wrote one original song, but we played like Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and whatever. I would try to play like fancy fills every now and then, but as soon as I went to Madison and I joined a band with Duke, who is in Garbage now as a guitarist. So I've known him for forever, you know, we've been mates for a long time. And I started playing more like Charlie or Ringo or Mick Fleetwood, you know, just really simple. And that's still how I play. And I think that has served me as a record producer, because it's like the drums need to work with the song, you know? So if you see me play, I play parts. Like rarely is there a spot in the song where I go, oh, I've got my two bar fill here, I can come up with anything. Once I sort of know the arrangement, that's what I play. And when I occasionally, I have thrown in a weird fill and the whole band just looks at me like, oh, what just happened? Like our bass player on this last tour, Daniel, or a couple of moments ago, you should just throw in a crazy filler. I go, okay. So like a split second in the song, it's usually, I can't do it when Shirley's singing, cause it might throw her off.
Right.
But I swear to God, I played a fill, like at some a crazy triplet fill over four or whatever. And everybody just like, whoa, what happened? It's like someone fell down the stairs.
Such had two coffees earlier, right?
So I just, you know, I have an arrangement and I stick to it. So
I like, that's what I recognize in your playing and in your production, is you understand the value and power of the drum hook.
Yes.
As much as the guitar hook.
Yeah. You know, I tell drummers that all the time. If you've got a fill coming in, or you're doing a turnaround thing and a beat, you know, make that groove the hook, or come up with these parts and then repeat them. They become motifs in a song. The king of that is Dave Grohl. I mean, listen to his drums on Nevermind. Every part is thought out and repeated, and it's and they're hooky, you know. And that's such a great, valuable lesson for young drummers to understand that.
Well, I think also, you know, it points to the truth of the matter, which took me years to realize it's the truth. People listen to two things on records. They listen to the voice, because that's the emotional content, and they listen to the rhythm.
Yep.
And everything else is, you know, frippery. We've been sort of relegated to the back when we should actually be, you know, pretty much up at the front a lot of the time, because that's what people react to.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's the voice and the drums.
Yeah, yeah. It's the groove, man. Yeah. Yeah, because the voice, if the groove doesn't support the singer, the song is not going to happen. That's it, you know.
I used to love, if I heard a band or saw, I love guitar entries, I love intros, but it's when the drums came in and the bass drum hit, I thought, that's what I want to do. Whatever that is, I want to do it, you know.
That thing is there, yeah.
In Garbage, we have taken little loops and things that sometimes we'll write songs to. And on our first album, we wrote Stupid Girl over that Topper Hegan groove.
Wow.
And The Clash, Train in Vain.
Yeah.
And so it's got... We sampled that, and then I played drums and programmed drums and, you know, did overdubs on top of it. And then when we finished the record, our managers and the label said, well, we're not going to be able to get clearance on this, on the Clash sample. You know, we're going to have to pay for it and probably give some publishing up. So you should try to recreate it. So I went back into the studio and I spent 2 days playing that drum part and trying to listen to it and EQ it, tune the snare, get the reverb and compression. And it sounded pretty good, but it didn't sound the same. And all of a sudden the band went, screw it, man. We love that Topper Hedon groove on Train in Vain. And so we said, call them up and let's work out a deal. And to me, that's that groove and that bass line is what makes Stupid Girl such a powerful song. Mm. You know?
Yeah, no, it is. Once I think about it.
And your drum fill and your snare fill. That's
oh,
the
yeah.
One. I love
it. Yeah,
that.
Right on.
Can we just pause a moment? Can we pause a moment and give a big, like, you know, for Topper? Because he's just like, Topper's my hero.
It's one of Train of Vain is fantastic. London Calling, that whole record stylistically is just a brilliant tour de force. It's one of my, it's in my top 10 albums of all time. I had to come up with a like 3 or 4 months ago, I was talking to a journalist and he asked me my top 5 drummers, and one of them is Topper, and another is Paul Thompson from Roxy Music.
Yeah.
I was the president of the Roxy Music fan club in Madison, Wisconsin. There were only 7 members, and I was a self-appointed president, but giant Roxy fan. I love Paul Thompson's playing because he, again, really simple. He did a lot of double time, like do-do-do-do-do-do, double time the snare. Always came up with great fills.
Great fills.
I mean, the whole band just, they all had a unique style, Phil Manzanera, and it's like they were so good. And we used to, when the band that Duke and I were in college before we started Garbage, we played, you know, some of the covers that we did were Roxy covers, and they were always so much fun to play live. And so anyway, much respect to Paul also.
Please, let's shout out for Paul Thompson with his leopard skin top, you know.
Right.
Yeah. If anybody was like, shouldn't be wearing leopard skin, it was Paul Thompson on that. But he knew it. But no, I saw Roxy Music, and it was later in the career, and they were on Polydor, so we got like tickets to get in there, and right. It was Avalon, and they had like the two singers either side of Ferry at Wembley Arena. And it wasn't Paul Thompson. It was Alan White, I think, or it's another guy who wore shorts. He was very 80s. And they went into Love is the Drug, and I'm waiting for the timbali fill, you know.
That's right. Boom. So good. So good. Yeah.
And it's like, he didn't do it. He did. He chose to lose a hook of the song and not do it.
That's the most important part of that song.
Of course.
That's it. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that's the most important part of the song.
He did something spectacular. He did like a kind of, you know, multi-triplet skim around the kit that nobody could even visualize.
Yeah, but it's not the timbales. It's not the timbales.
Not the timbales.
Yeah, yeah. you know, I missed, Roxy just came through L.A. last September, October, and I had tickets. Our tour manager, Levi, also is very good friends with Brian Ferry. And he was one of the, I think he was Brian's personal tour manager. Anyway, I was so excited to see them. And unfortunately, I got COVID like 4 days before. And I was like, will I be okay in 4 or 5 days? I felt like shit. I was fine. But like for 3 or 4 days, I just laid in bed and hacked and coughed. So I missed that show. And everyone said they were incredible, that the band was amazing. Brian Ferry sang great. And apparently Phil Manzanera was on fire on guitar. Like people were like, holy shit, he's a true rock guitar god, you know.
It's funny how early recordings, we got close to Phil Manzanera. We worked at his studio. He had a place called the Coach House. And it was like the first time you went into it, and it wasn't a brown room. It looked like a kind of very nice living room.
Yeah.
With kabuki things draped around, and so it just changed the way you felt about playing. These guys knew what they were doing,
right. It wasn't shag carpet all over it. Was he wearing those glasses with the lines across them, like the spider glasses or whatever?
He wasn't there. No, he didn't turn it. I think he'd stopped living there.
Can I ask you, so you have a new album?
Yeah, we're very excited because we started it sort of like at the beginning of COVID, and Budgie, you know, I met Budgie when he came out here with John Grant, and we hung out, and we started to do something. So he came back to LA, and we worked up with Jackknife up in Topanga, where he has his studio.
Cool.
And then Budgie just escaped just in time before the whole country, the whole world closed down for COVID, you know?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
But we'd done the drum tracks and we had the loops in place and all the kind of...
Yes.
And we started farming tracks out to vocalists. We thought we maybe... Because it was going to be an instrumental, really. We were going to be quite happy with another Green World or something, you know, Evening Star.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
But James Murphy, LCD Sound System.
Great, fantastic, yeah.
So James came back and said... You know, I'd love to, but he took a while.
Yeah, took a while.
And then Bobby Gillespie.
Right on.
Bobby came up with like 3 lyrics, melodies.
Three tracks, yeah.
Cool.
And then we had just like kind of build the things around him, you know, and suddenly we had like a whole different project. And now we have to figure out how do we do it live? Because we want to go out there.
Yeah, yeah. That's exciting. Yeah, you got to play some live shows, you know. Even if it's not a long tour, do like some showcases in LA and New York and London or Berlin, whatever. So,
well, we're setting up some ones for like LA, New York, and London, and trying to get as many people in as possible to do it. And then we might do what we call the suitcase tour, which basically me and Budgie living out of suitcases. No, me and Budgie taking, you know, it on the road, but with a lot of machines and stuff, and maybe 1 or 2 extra people, you know. So
yeah. That's exciting. Are you going to do a video too, or have you done a video?
That's why I'm dressed this way. I kind of pulled this together quickly for a photo shoot a few months back, and then we've done like a composite, and that's the kind of press release photo. A same photographer, but like in 3 different locations around the globe.
Yep.
And anyway, so I picked this up in the local little town here in France where I am. on Saturdays in the middle of the vegetable market, see the gents outfitters, and I want a black tie and a white shirt. And they're going like, oh, je suis désolé, monsieur. C'est un relative. Malheureusement, we, il est mort. I said, no, it's for a photograph. It's okay. I'm really happy. Nobody's died.
Oh, il est mort, yes.
But it kind of feels, it makes me feel kind of like, you know, formal and get anyway, we're going to try and do a little we're doing everything on minuscule budget for videos, so it's
yeah, because we spent all the money on the first video. There we have a video on YouTube right now for Los Angeles.
Oh cool, I'll check it out. Yeah, I'll check it out.
Yeah, so we'll see how we get on with our GoPro and our Ring camera. We're gonna have distorted nose.
Yeah, everybody's doing it, you know.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, Butch, because it was very early on in Garbage, the life of the band, but people were telling me, the reports came in that it was really quiet on stage and everything was like the drums were kind of triggering rather than acoustic drums. What was going on at that? You were like almost bringing a studio sound to the stage.
Well, yeah, it was quite daunting. Putting together those first Garbage tours, I played drum workshop drums for a long time, so I had a drum workshop kit, but then we deadened the drums down, so they were just completely dead, like put towels and styrofoam inside them, the kick, even the snares, so kind of like hitting pads, like you know when you do a video and they deaden everything down,
right? Yeah,
except the cymbals were still alive, all totally live, but then we put plexiglass around the cymbals,
yeah,
so they wouldn't go out into the stage, and so Shirley could move around and then I used you guys probably played with this. It was the D Drum 3 was the first or one of the triggers back then that right. It was the reason I got it was fast. It triggered like 2 or 3 milliseconds, so there wasn't a lag when you hit it. Yeah. And so it was mono and only 8-bit, but you could put a sample in and it sounded pretty good. So I took the samples from the Garbage songs from each song and I could load it in for, say, Vow or Queer or Stupid Girl or whatever. And then you could change it from song to song. So I'd hit the drums and there were no mics on the acoustic drums, just 2 overheads on the cymbals. And then so my mix was all playing the acoustic drums but triggering the samples. And it was a little archaic, and we figured out how to make it sounded, our sound man grew to love it because you didn't have all the bombast of all the drums, and Shirley of course loved it because the stage was quiet, you know, so she could sing really dynamic. The last 4 tours I started playing the Roland TD-50X. It's a dedicated electronic kit and it has its own built-in samples, but like in the past I load in my own Garbage samples, so each song when we started it loads up and I've got all my custom kicks and snares and stuff, and this is great because it's 24-bit and stereo and wow. It sounds really good.
Yeah.
And so yeah, if you stand on the stage, and we all wear inner ears, there's no wedges on stage, so if you stand on the side of the stage you don't hear anything.
No.
You hear me tapping on the tick 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 and you hear Shirley singing and of course it's blaring through the PA, so but it's everyone loves it because it allows everyone, their headphone mix is really good, really clear, because you don't have to fight with all of the stage volume, you know.
No, so, spill.
And I think that's honestly one of the reasons we're still able to go out and tour it, because it sounds good and it's not, you know, you can come home from a tour in the past. I used to come before I was in Garbage. I'd go on tour with some of my bands and my ears would just ring for days. And I'm like, I got very nervous about that because I'm a record producer. You know, I want to protect my ears as much as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We can't hear anything. I have these in. Yes. Well, no. I've got my in-ears in now because I just get comfortable with them.
Yeah,
But I do remember when I first started to wear them. I mean, I was wearing headphones quite early on with the Banshees just because we wanted to get the wedges off the stage. We put the wedges under the stage, but we didn't want anything blocking the projection at the back. So it was more like a visual decision.
Yeah, yeah.
But I never liked people with headphones on, you know, because it looked too studio. So the in-ears are kind of great because we don't see them.
Yeah.
But everybody's got to have them. Otherwise, the situation with me on the John Grant tour was there was very little going on stage. Everything was DI'd, except my kit. And the kit was live. And the clubs, we were playing small venues. So the sound was great. But so you'd have an acoustic guitar and an electric piano. And then suddenly I'd come in, big entry. And there's like, I'm sure in the front row, all you're going to hear is drum kit. And I thought, it was really odd. I'm trying to figure out, how do we do this? You know, it was kind of a bit of a head mess up, you know.
We, Garbage went to the Royal Albert Hall and played the James Bond, I think it was the 60th anniversary.
Okay.
They asked us to play, we did that theme song, The World Is Not Enough. And so we went in the day before and did a rehearsal, and it was great. So I'm listening to Shirley Bassey, you know, like with a 70-piece orchestra. It sounded so frigging good. And then they go, okay, Garbage, you're up next. And I rolled out my TD-50, the electric kit, and the orchestra stood up and went, "We're so glad you're not playing acoustic drums." Because I was right. They sat me up right next to the conductor.
Yeah.
And if I've been playing a kit, you know, I play that song pretty hard. And right. It would have been crap, boom, gaka, boom, gaba, boom, gaka, boom, ba. Instead, I'm just tapping away and you can hear the strings. And they put my drums and everybody, you know, they all wear have inner ear things so they can hear the conductor and whatever. And it sounded great. Everybody who was at the, I mean, I heard some of the feed that it was broadcast, and I thought the mix sounded fantastic.
There's moments, so when you enjoy that thing, though, like the loudness of the drums, because I played in LA with like this, I guess it's sort of like, it's like a comedy show and they have a band and stuff. They put together the band and it's just all different people. And so I would play with that from time to time. And I had like a little cocktail kit, you know, a little Tamo cocktail kit that had like samples on it. And I could play with that. But I always made sure I had the big crash right in front of me, because that's where the horn players would sit in front of me, you know.
And yeah, yeah.
Loud bastards and, you know, like dropping bits of spit out their things and that. So
yeah, yeah.
Every so often when I wanted them to get a few further, you know, a little further away, I would smash the crash really loud, you know, and they'd all move forward a couple of feet and that. They're lovely fellows, though, really.
Yeah, I mean, if you look through my door back here, I've got a TD-50 set up as a practice kit, and then I have a DW kit up that's wired so I can record drums here. And I still love playing the acoustic kit. There's nothing like it, you know. It's like,
it's a certain feel about it.
It's like therapy. Playing drums is therapy, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's therapy, and also it's good exercise for us as we get older as well.
Yeah, man.
What about the Roland sample pads? You know, their little the Roland sample pad, because I'm thinking of calling them up and getting myself.
Oh, yeah. I've got a bunch of electronic drum things here. Yeah. Not all set up here right now, but in the room out there. And we always have that, you know, because we sort of take a lot of samples and things in Garbage when we're recording and put it in so you can play them. I might sample, it might be noise,
right,
but I like to be able to play it with sticks or with my hands. And so that's part of how we record.
Good. Good, absolutely. Well, that's great, because that's what we're refining that, because we made this record, you know, and I had a look at all the multi-tracks the other day, because I'm putting them on, you know, like put them in Ableton or something to play, you know, for the suitcase thing.
Yeah.
I'm looking at them and there's like some tracks on the album, 70 tracks. Oh my God. We can't put that in Ableton. I won't be able to see it. So I have to comp everything down, you know, like.
Oh. Gotta submix it all down. Yeah. Mix stems.
Yeah. Submix it all down and make a choice. Do we really need that sound of the, you know, the sausage waving outside in the air or whatever it was, you know. Is that really an important part of the track?
I have to ask myself that every time we mix a Garbage song. You know, we're making a new record, because by the time we're done, there's like over 100 tracks, and you're mixing in the bridge, or there's this thing that comes in. Does that really need to be there? And, you know, whoever came up with the part, of course it needs to be there. I worked for hours on that little fiddly part there. I mean, you go, let's just mute it and see what it sounds like. And But that's the great thing about recording these days. The technology is just amazing. It allows you to try anything, and you can just, let's take the course and just drop it in here and see what that sounds like, or take this riff and put it on the end. And
gone are the days of razor blade and endless bits of tape.
Well, I was going to say, I give us some behind the scenes. For instance, was Nevermind recorded in straight takes?
Yep, on tape. Yep.
Yeah.
And I was the king of razor blade editing back in the day. I mean, I was really good at it. And
the fastest blade in the West.
I would have a band play three or four takes and say, "Okay, go to the pub and get a beer and come back in 45 minutes, and I'll put a master take together." And it was great.
You were confident. You sent them off to the pub between takes. That's like four takes. You go off to the pub. You know they could not come back and recreate that. I want you to play like you did in the first take. They go, "Sure, no problem. Hey,
yeah.
We're pros. We've just been down
half speed or twice the speed." Yeah.
I think because I was a drummer, I knew, okay, take two was good, but the fills on three were good, and the intro was best on take one. So I would take notes and go, right. I'm pretty sure we've got it. Now go to the pub.
we did that with sort of the modern alternative with this record. We, Budgie stayed at my house, and we would drive every day up to Topanga, and we would sit in the studio with Jackknife, and we play records, we drink coffee, we talk, and then we go, "Should we make some music?" And we go and make some music, and then about dinner time, we'd head off home, and the next morning we'd come back up, and he'd press play, and he'd go, "What do you think?" And suddenly there was this big track that he'd assembled out of all the nonsense we played.
It's so great. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's very much how garbage works too. But it's fun. It's exciting because when you go into the studio, you come up with ideas and you don't know where it's going to end up. It's just kind of this crazy adventure, and it's exciting.
We all remember like heading to the studio and sort of like you're kind of circling round the point of entering the arena or setup, whether you're set up in the round or you're all in separate booths. Are you actually all in the same mood at the same time? Are we going to hit it? Are we going to? And you just look across the studio and you think, "Oh God, no, they're never going to do it. They're just like, no, they're not even here." But you've got like 2 hours before dinner, and then it's not going to happen.
2 hours left. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Moments of like doubt come like the extra push to get it this time. And also then there's a mistake, and the mistake was better than anything you could have planned.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if you've got somebody with a good razor blade, they can actually cut it in and make it work in the real take.
Well, the secret is to know what's a good happy accident, what's a bad happy accident. Because when it was just down to two of us in the queue, just me and Bob, we made a single for the first time. We had a producer, not just an engineer that helped us produce stuff. And we had Steve Nye, who had worked with Japan and stuff.
Yeah.
And so we got a whole load of like Oberheim, sequencers, drum machine, the keyboards. And, that was my job to try and put it all together and make it work. And I'm looking at it all and, at the beginning of the walk, there's like this big note that just kept chiming every time, and I couldn't figure out a way. How can we turn that off in the sequence? We can't turn it off. And so we just kept it in the song, and it's the start of the song. But I always remember Steve Nye said to me, I was hitting buttons and trying to figure out what was going on, and I was getting frustrated. And he turned around to me and he said, "Lowell, do you know what that needs? What you're doing?" I said, "No. If you could help me," he went, yeah, it needs some RFM. I said, "What's RFM, Steve?" He said, "Read the fucking manual." Which I did.
Wait, do you mean frequency modulation or read the friggin' manual? Yeah.
Yes, right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't read manuals. I sort of like to get something and just start trying to figure it out. And then I'm going, "Fucking, this isn't working. God, and usually you can get it to work, but occasionally I can't get any sound. So I, you know, these days you can go on YouTube and go, how do you use this particular software thing? And then there's somebody go and do this, so you can get sound up pretty quick. But
right.
I like to sort of just get it and see if I can figure it out intuitively without having to spend an hour reading a manual.
You might know this story. I was told this story by Talvin Singh, good old friend, tabla player.
Yeah.
Talvin played with Bjork and toured America with us on the Lollapalooza tour, that first one. But he was saying that when in Bollywood, they received all these old Telefunken desks and recording equipment from Germany. And of course, all the manuals were in German. So they just switched everything on, and they figured it was all going correctly when everything was in the red. And so that's why all these Bollywood productions, the early recordings, are all kind of
crunchy. You're right; they're kind of crunchy. Yeah.
And the string sound, the big orchestra sound, like tape overload completely, and that's the sound of the
and then they get used to doing that. They get used to that sound, so then they just do it over and over and again because that's the way it's supposed to sound.
Had they read the friggin' manual, we wouldn't have had that sound.
You know, the other thing, like you were saying, like, you know, like nowadays, because, you know, everybody has one of these, he said, holding up his phone. I just put it on a tripod and I get Jackknife to explain to me what he's doing and we film it, you know. That's how I did it this weekend. Like, you know, doing all these tracks together, let me just film it and we'll sit there. Now you have to remember not to swear too much while you're doing it.
I was going to sort of think, well, how should we, you know, round things up a bit? Because we could talk about drums all night and we could talk about gear and stuff.
All bloody night. We could even talk about the studio that you did, never mind, because I was in there a few months later. It's out in Burbank, was it? Somewhere like that, right?
It's in the valley near, I guess technically Van Nuys. As you go up the 405, whatever, it's in like a nondescript, like a mall, you know.
Yeah. See, because I had this thing with it at the time, you know, because at the time I left The Cure, I got my first post Cure band together, and we had a deal with some label in Chicago, and they put us in there, and I was thinking, you know, oh, this is I heard there was this record made in here. So we got to do something, because like all these plaid coated guys are killing us. You know, because it was like you couldn't get arrested with anything for a while there, with, you know, like grunge, Nirvana, everything. That was the whole deal, you know. And we were like, oh, okay, well, might as well stop. We went in there with John Porter, who did the Smiths and stuff.
And Roxy Music. Yeah. He produced Roxy Music too.
Yeah. So it was good. It was good fun. But we were under heavy manners a bit, because we saw the writing on the wall, what's coming next, you know?
Yeah.
And we weren't it at that moment.
Yeah. I tell you what, I've just been listening to I was in this old car I have over here in France, just sits around. It's okay. It's an old, it's got a cassette machine, and it's got a cassette player in it. And I've also got all the old boxes of cassettes and vinyl down here as well, which have been in storage for ages. And my son, who's 9, he armed himself with all the cassettes. Let's see if the cassette player's working, Daddy. And he puts in a compilation sent to me, I remember ages ago, of reggae, dub stuff, put together in a kind of...
Wow, that was probably great.
It's great. It's just put together in a way that you would if you were like a DJ, and so everything, nothing stops, just continues. But it's like the song, and then it breaks down into a dub kind of session, and then the next track starts. So I remember a song called, it's this one, and I remember it was 18 with a bullet.
Yes.
Got my finger on the trigger, I'm gonna pull it. And they're just like beautiful vocals.
Yeah.
Then they catch a note or a chord, and jank, 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 jank. And for the longest time, nothing happens. And then the beat comes back in. I thought the bravery of pulling everything to pieces and letting it come back together, it was so creative.
So I'm interested to think to hear what Cosmo thought of it.
Interesting, because he's a trumpet player, and he's really and he's noticing that the tonalities and stuff there, and it's amazing what kids pick up on when you think this is really cool, and they go like, "Well, I'm not sure, it's a bit complicated."
Yeah, we have a really good reggae dub Spotify list that we play. It's like 2 or 3 hours backstage at Garbage. Sometimes it's hard to be in a bad mood when you put on a kick-ass reggae dub thing. I think it's called like the Summer Sound System or something. You put it on and the crew are going by, what are you guys playing back there? It's just, I don't even know all the artists. It's something randomly that we've been putting into a Spotify list for a while, but it's great. Every time you put it on, it makes you feel good.
It's interesting how you can hear the beginnings of rap coming through from the toasting of the MCs, you know.
Totally.
They're just kind of riffing on words, and they always had certain notes they'd use as well, regardless of what the key was. It's rhythmic stuff, and it's interesting. And then I remember on that Insomnia tour where I was just taking photographs, LL Cool J's Rock the Bells had just come out, and Run DMC, and I loved all that stuff, and I wanted to play like that, you know, like I wanted to play like Kraftwerk when I heard Kraftwerk for the first time. It was really funny the way, as a drummer, you could change your identity, you know, within the band, and totally change the band.
Totally, yeah.
I've got a title for your new book then, Musical Insomniac. There you go.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, if I could be Insomniac now, I'd probably write a lot more.
Yeah, so at 3 a.m., Budgie, you take photos out of the window and you put on a dub sound system, man, and just stare out into space at that hotel window.
Butch, thanks for coming on. It's an honor, really. I got dressed up, you know, in your honor, because
right on.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it. It's like I said, this was really a treat. I have much respect for both of you. I'm super excited to hear your album. Oh, I will. Yeah. I'll check it out.
Well, we'll send you a copy. We will. We must do.
Yeah, gentlemen, it was awesome. A pleasure. And maybe let's do it again. You know, if you run out of gas at some point, just give me a call.
Yep, we'll just circle around.
Yeah, we'll circle it around, yeah. All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks so much, it's great talking to you. Have a good one.
Cheers. Curious Creatures is presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio design, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Associate producer and digital marketing, Marge Taylor.
Visual designer, Justin Thomas K.
Music production, Jack Knifley.
Assistant editor, Ben Miller.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2024.